my house flooded in the Florida hurricanes. Actually, it was a great lesson because you, it was, you know, everybody says material things don't matter, but until you actually experience it, they truly don't. I mean, I lost so many things, and it's like, kind of life goes on. There's a fine line between cheating and gamesmanship, right? Because I always felt like there was two battles going on the tennis court, right? There was the physical battle and the mental battle. And you want to have the mental edge over your opponents because then the physical part becomes easier. I think it's kind of annoying that the men play five sets. I have to say,
okay,
it's like, get it done already.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
I mean, you don't need five sets. Just play three.
Right.
It's, I mean, for the fans and for the speed of the tournament and the speed of the game, I think the grand slam should go to 2 out of 3.
All right, welcome to our Tennis Worthy podcast, everyone. Patrick McEnroe, president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, never to be confused as an actual Hall of Famer, because I have one with me today who also happens to be very connected to the International Tennis Hall of Fame in more ways than just being, I shouldn't say just being a Hall of Famer. She's also on our board, and she does lots of activities with us to promote the Hall of Fame. The one and only Gigi Fernandez. Gigi, welcome to the Tennis Worthy podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yesterday, Gigi, we had the opportunity, both of us, along with lots of our team at the Hall of Fame, to unveil a great project along with Google Arts and Culture. They were able to digitize the magazine, the American Lawn Tennis magazine, all the issues from the early, really the first 50-some years of the 1900s, and put them online. I was blown away by what we saw.
Yeah, that was quite impressive. Like 1907 to 1951, one magazine per month, every page of every publication digitalized for anybody to see. But the most impressive part to me was the whole AI component, because, I mean, if you have 50 years of magazines, it's kind of hard to comb through that to find what you're looking for. But you can just ask Google AI any question about anything that happened in that time, and it'll not only spit out the answer on, you know, written answer, but it also create like a little podcast audio version of the answer. So I was blown away. I didn't know, you know, this technology obviously existed, but the world is a new place.
It's a new place. And it was, you know, what impressed me was seeing the way they kind of broke down different topics, different subjects. So, you know, the history of rackets, for example, or the history of, you know, when women started in big time professional tennis. So all those kind of stories within the stories to me was incredible to see. Both you and I were able to speak to a crowd that assembled there. The head of Google Arts and Culture was there as well. And it was pretty cool to see. And I got to give a lot of credit to our team at the museum, Nicole and company, for putting this all together and working as hard as they have. This has been a 4 or 5 year project to make this happen and to put it together.
Yeah, it was 30,000 pages that had to get scanned. So that took a lot of work, and the Google team was really impressive. It was kind of fun to being in the Google office. There's an actual train. And did you catch the train going up to?
I did see the train. Yeah, I walked. You know, I tried to get my steps in, but I caught the
train.
You took the train.
I was in high heels, which doesn't happen very often. But of course, I was cramping last night on my calves because I never wear heels. But
well, you flew in for the event from Florida up to New York City. So we appreciated that. That was cool that you did that. And you're quite involved with all things Hall of Fame, and we appreciate that. Let's go now to, first of all, I want to just talk a little bit about your career, because you are a Hall of Famer, 17 majors in doubles, one time I made the mistake of saying you won an Olympic gold, and you quickly corrected me, 2 Olympic gold medals. So I'm giving.
We defended it, yes.
Yeah, so you played with the same partner?
Yeah, I played with Mary Jo Fernandez.
Mary Jo, well, how could I forget that? My cohort at ESPN for so many years. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So we got paired in Barcelona, and it was sort of not, I mean, Marty Reason was a coach, and he put us together, and we ended up winning the gold medal. We beat the Spaniards in Spain, which was a lot of fun. Mm. That final match, packed stadium.
Arantxa
and Conchita.
Wow. That's a great win.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'll tell the funny story, because the stadium was packed except for there was 2 empty seats, like right in the front row, which is kind of weird. And we were just cruising along, 6-2, 3-1. I'm serving 30-15. I have, you know, two points away from being up at 7-4-1. And between my first and my second serves, these two people walk on the court, and they walk to those two seats. They didn't wait for the changeover. They didn't even wait for me to finish my point, like between my first and my second serve. So I'm fuming because I have to wait for them to take their seat. And of course, I double fault. And I go up to Mary Jo and I go, God damn it, Mary Jo, what are those people doing? She goes, Gigi, calm down. It's the king and the queen of Spain.
Oh my God. They can come in anytime they want, right?
Yeah, and they've been showing up at the gold medal matches, and the Spaniards would, elevate their games and win gold medals. And sure enough, they won like six games in a row. We got down 2-0 in the third, and then we ended up coming back and winning in the third. And then
Wow.
we were lucky to defend in Atlanta in '96.
So Atlanta, so obviously Spain was on the clay, and then you defended in Atlanta on a hard court. And who did you play in the gold medal
We
match there?
beat the Czechs,
Okay.
Sukova and Novotná. And that was a bit disappointing because we followed Andre Agassi's gold medal win, and
Right.
everybody left. There was no one there.
Oh,
Everybody
well, that's
watch
sort of this
Agassi
that can often be the story of doubles. I mean,
for doubles. Absolutely.
my one title I won at a major was in doubles at the French Open, and it was a Raptor. It was in 89, I believe. Yeah, I think it was 89. There's that epic final. I think it was Steffi and Monica. It was maybe Steffi and Iraqi. It was one of their like all-time great women's finals. 8-6 in the third, whatever it was. And by the time we finished, and we played best of five in the final, by the time Ginny Graeb and I won, there was probably like 100 people in the stadium, and we were playing French guys in the final. So there you go.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's just that the scheduling of the finals of Grand Slams, particularly at the French. I mean, we never had because of the French, because we used to play like at 11 and the men's final was at 3.
Right,
And
right.
they actually we used to start at closer to 12 or 12:30. And then one year Natasha and I played this really long 3-set match that bled into the start of the men's final. And
Oh
it's
man,
and I mean, I
right.
could see everybody like,
Right,
panicking,
talking,
get off the court, but we're still playing.
right. You're playing for the
So
title.
what after the year after that, they moved the final start time 2 hours earlier, so that wouldn't happen again.
Well, this kind of leads me into a little, one of the topics I want to get into with you today, because it's one of the topics we're covering this month on the Tennis Worthy podcast. We try to sort of have a topic each month, and the topic this month is tradition. There are traditions in tennis, and this one of them, right? Having doubles, mixed doubles, singles at all the majors. That's the only tournaments that do that. Of course, the U.S. Open is breaking tradition big time this year, and how they're doing the mixed doubles. So that's
Big time.
a topic for another day. We'll see how that pans out. But as I looked it up in preparing for this podcast and others, I looked up traditions on, like you said, on of course on Google. That now that they're supporting us at the Hall of
Google
Fame,
AI, yes.
mostly what came up was Wimbledon traditions, and you won Wimbledon multiple times. What were your favorite traditions at Wimbledon?
Well, I mean, believe it or not, there's this split locker room at Wimbledon. So there's like the seeded player locker room, then there's
Right.
the rest of the world locker room, and then there's the qualifier locker room. So I think that's pretty cool that you, I mean, if you're, and then for seeded.
And now, by the way, there's a junior locker room, which is
Yeah,
available
that's
over at the
not even
practice
on
court.
site. Like that's like at Aurangi or something.
Right, right,
They
right.
don't get to be in our locker room. But for doubles players, if you were in the top two seeds, they would put you in the seeded player locker room. So that was a really
Oh,
special
only the top two seeds
in doubles, only the top
in
two seeds
doubles.
would get in the seeded player
Wow.
locker room. Yeah. I don't know if it's changed, but that was when I was playing. Another tradition I liked about Wimbledon was that the men's champion would always start,
Yeah, defending champion men plays the first match on Monday,
then the women on
woman
Tuesday.
on Tuesday, correct? Yeah.
Right.
So you
Right.
know if, as
So
soon
that's
as you
kind
win that tournament, when
you
you're
know
going to
your
play the
start
first
time.
match. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
And you also know
But
the
for
easiest.
the fans too, like
Right. Strawberries and cream, and
yes, strawberries and
apparently
cream,
strawberries.
the
So,
royalty
let's
there.
switch topics to something. Yeah, apparently they've been doing strawberries and cream since Wimbledon began, the first tournament ever.
Wow.
Wimbledon, they've been doing
Did
it
you find
for
that
so
out at on the Google AI thing?
Of course I did. Yeah, no, absolutely I did. And the other one is Pimm's with a sort of an alcoholic drink. But there's certain traditions about Wimbledon. The courts, obviously. The pristine grass courts. We have our own pristine grass court at the Newport Tennis Hall of Fame, which we are very proud of. And we like to compare them to Wimbledon. But the truth is, there's really nothing like the grass courts
There's
at
nothing
Wimbledon.
like
You
Wimbledon.
play, yeah, there's nothing like Wimbledon when it comes to a lot of things, but
And then there's
particularly the
one tradition
courts.
at Wimbledon that I was kind of sad to see go, and that's the curtsy. Remember, you used to
Oh,
have to,
right,
when you walked
right.
into the center
Yep.
court, you have to turn and then curtsy to the royal box. I thought that was it made it kind of special and
Yeah.
unique, and I'm kind of bummed that players don't have to curtsy anymore.
Yeah, and the male players would kind of do like a bat like bow, right,
They
to
could
the royal
bow. Yeah, they'd
box.
have to
Yeah,
bow.
take a bow.
It was
Yeah,
just
so they got rid of that.
I thought it was pretty cool.
And by the way, the reason they still have the rule of to wear all whites at Wimbledon, I talked to you about this before we started recording.
Yeah, you didn't tell me the answer.
Okay, I'm going to tell you now, because back in the day, they didn't want the women to be seen sweating, because that was deemed like inappropriate.
Unladylike.
So they said, well, can we wear white so you can't see the sweat? You see that?
And that's a tradition that's still pervasive still in the Northeast of,
yes, right,
of our country. And that's about exactly. It. Only yep. In the Northeast. The first time I went to a club and they said, you have to wear all white. I'm like, what? Is it Wimbledon? Are we playing at Wimbledon?
They try to change with the times. And, but there's – I love getting there – that weekend before the tournament begins, and I'm usually there for TV purposes, and I always walk the ground and just see the way, you know, the flowers are perfect and the courts and the meticulous preparation of the courts. And I even love during the tournament to get there early before the fans can come on the grounds and seeing them prep the courts, you know, the
it's pretty cool. What about other Grand Slam traditions?
Well, that's what I'm thinking about. Well, there's night tennis. I mean, that became a tradition that started at the U.S. Open.
The Open,
Yeah, it started actually at Forest Hills because I was there for one of the most famous matches when my brother played Nastasi. You remember that when John, he was still a teenager. I think it was late 70s.
That was too early for me.
Yeah, so it was just I was, you know, whatever I was, 10 years old watching, and that was when a gunshot went off outside the stadium, and it stopped the match. And then Frank Hammond, who was a chair umpire, Nastasi was going crazy because John was winning the match fairly easily, so Nastasi created this whole uproar, and they actually got Frank Hammond out of the chair in the middle of the match. That's a chair umpire. And what's his name? He was a tournament supervisor. His name will come to me. Blanchard. He came in and he went into the chair, and he'd had a couple of cocktails.
That's how times have changed.
Yeah, times have changed. But you know, night tennis. I think it's fascinating, Gigi, because that's a tradition that's kind of changed the complexion of all the majors now. It used to be, you know, at the French, you'd be done by dinner time, same at Wimbledon. And now even those tournaments, which have the most tradition of any, you know, more so than U.S. Open and Australian Open, have night tennis now, all four majors. Of course, Wimbledon, you know, put the roof in, and they all did. So that's one that has changed, has really modernized the majors, I think, in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a commercial decision, obviously. It's one extra session. I hope Wimbledon doesn't ever have a night session. And actually, I don't think they can because they're under a curfew. I think they have to be done by 10 11. Or 10:30. 11, yeah.
11,
so,
I think, yeah.
So you couldn't really have a night session. But one thing that the U.S. Open started, I'm sure you know this, but the viewers might not, a tradition of the night session of the Open is that the match that starts alternates – between men and women. So if today women start first and tomorrow it's men and then it's women and it's men. So that's how they kind of keep it fair, which I think is great. You don't always want the women second because that second match can go really long. I'm sure the guys don't love it because they have to play five sets starting at, 9:30 at night. But that's, to me, that's, I don't know, those second on matches aren't great. I just saw that at the Miami Open, I don't know if this is the ATP rule, but I don't know if it could apply to the Grand Slams, but they cannot start a match after 11.
Right.
So then Djokovic and Korda match was taken out.
Was pushed to the next day, yeah.
I know. So the people who had that ticket, I would be so mad. And they didn't get a refund. They didn't get anything. Yeah. So,
well, there is that's part of the challenge, isn't it? Because when you make the schedule and, they have to write on the ticket, it's subject to change. They do all that stuff.
Right.
But that's why that was the first time actually at a tournament of that level, men or women, that they pulled the plug on it. And I think in the long run, I think that's a good thing. Cause I think, the tennis world gets so much pushback when these matches go to, 2-3 in the morning especially in the majors.
So the question I had is, does the ATP and the WTA have control over what happens at the Grand Slams?
No,
so they can say we're not starting. So the Grand Slams can start you whenever.
Grand Slam can do whatever they want. Yeah.
And but what if the players, what if they protect the players and say, no, we're not playing. And then they just leave.
That could be problematic, but
double default.
Yeah, they do have, you know, there's representatives of the tours at the majors, so they kind of work with the tournament. But at the end of the day, and there's also the ITF, which oversees
the majors.
But the bottom line is each tournament can basically do what they want. That's the bottom line. At the end of the day, they can basically do what they want. But there's a couple other traditions, Gigi, and Gigi Fernandez joining me here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast, a Hall of Famer herself, the only Puerto Rican player. Now, Charlie Passarell is in the Hall of Fame as a contributor.
Yes.
But not he was obviously a great player. He got in for all that he did, you know, on and off the court. By the way, you could be in it as a contributor, too, for all you've done.
Oh, no, I don't think so, not yet.
Can you get in someday as a player and a contributor?
Well, Rosie's in twice.
Rosie's in twice because she was part of the.
But
nine.
It's fine. Yeah. I'm fine. We don't need that. But I'm not there yet. No, I haven't done enough.
You've done a lot. You've done a lot, and you're doing a lot in your programs you do in Florida and your tours.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you know about my foundation, but that's probably what I'm most excited about right now. After my house flooded in the Florida hurricanes, and I started this foundation called Tennis for Hope. And it was just an idea, a thought that came out of kind of desperation because I was so depressed. I've never been so depressed in my life. I mean, it was a great lesson because everybody says material things don't matter, but until you actually experience it, they truly don't. I mean, I lost so many things and it's like kind of life goes on. But that's what I decided to do. I decided to start this foundation and I gathered a board, a great board that's doing a lot of work. And we just, day before yesterday, we applied. So this is in 6 months. We already have 501c3 status. We applied in mid-February, and we just received our funding. But in the meantime, while I was waiting for funding, the WTA – I mean, while I was waiting for our 501c3 status, the WTA Foundation partnered with us under a fiscal sponsorship agreement. So they started collecting funds because when the LA fires hit, I was like, okay, Gigi, this is why you started this foundation. The foundation helps people in the tennis community recover and give some aid and relief that are affected by natural disasters. So here's the next natural disaster after the hurricanes was the LA fires. So we donated $50,000 to the Palisades Tennis Center. And then we just identified a club in Altadena that school actually in Altadena that needs help. So that's what I'm doing. And I think that's yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I have always felt this responsibility to give back because I always feel like if, you know, the Superman line was with great power comes great responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I turned out to with great talent comes great responsibility. And when you have this, we both have this God given talent that I feel it's our job or duty to share and pass on. So I just do what I can.
Well done. Well done to you. And I want to ask you, cause I've never asked you this and I'm actually interested just to know, how did you get started in tennis? How were your beginnings playing in Puerto Rico, which as we know is, you know, not a tennis hotbed, but how did you make it?
Yeah. So this is super personal story that I just learned about a year ago, why my family actually started playing tennis. We had this family event it was almost turned into a tragic event, but it wasn't. My brother had an accident and he was, you know, died on the way to the hospital, was revived. Like he was not in good shape for a few months or a few years. And my mom was so desperate and so upset about the whole thing that she needed an outlet. And she had some friends who said, well, why don't you come to the club and, you know, play tennis? So she's like, okay. So she went to the club in the afternoons and, you know, started playing tennis. So that's, you know, because my mom and I was at the time, I was probably 3 or 4 at the time when this happened. So we started going to the club in the afternoons after school and I started hitting against the wall. And then Luis Ayala, Chilean former top 10 player was lived in Puerto Rico at the time. And I kept asking for lessons for my birthday and I didn't get him at 4. I didn't get him at 5. I didn't get him at 6. And finally I got him at 7. And I just had God given talent. You know, I had really good hand-eye coordination and, you know, and I think my dad helped develop that by complete accident because we played this game where he would stand on the service line with a basket of balls and I was standing in the opposite service line across the net. And he would take the basket of balls and he'd try to hit me with the balls. You know, he'd be like, I'm trying to hit you. It was a game, right? I mean, he wasn't going to hit me, but I just was trying to reflect the balls back. Defending,
amazing hands.
Yeah, and then he'd say, okay, defend it to that alley. And I'm like, okay, I'll try to defend it to that alley. And then defend it to this alley. So that's probably how I got my hands. And then because the Puerto Rico Tennis Association is part of the United States Tennis Association, then I was able to play USTA tournaments. So I would come to the U.S. in the summers And then I was discovered by a college coach, offered a scholarship, and I made the finals of NCAA as a freshman, playing for Clemson University, and then I turned pro after that.
So you just spent 1 year at Clemson.
Yeah, I might have gone back, but I played two of my team, and the girl, and I made the finals and lost 7-6 in the third to Beth Herr, who was ranked 27th in the world at the time. And the girl that I lost, that played number one, lost first round. So I thought I've earned my spot at number one,
Right,
but she was a
right.
returning senior, so I asked him if I went back if he could guarantee that I'd play number one, and only not because I wanted to play one, it's just because I lost two matches all year, so I figured I needed
Right,
more
right,
competition.
right.
So he said I was going to have to play a challenge match, and dreaded challenge matches
Right.
in college,
Right.
right?
Right.
So
I think you would have
I
won
didn't
that
go back.
challenge match, but I think you made the right decision turning pro.
Yeah.
What a couple of the traditions I think we take for granted because, we've done it our whole life, but I always found it, the respect that, comes with being a tennis player, obviously the shaking hands after the matches. What drives me crazy now, Gigi, as just a fan of tennis and particularly as you mentioned college tennis, there's a lot of cheating that goes on, and I get the videos all the time. People send them to me. I'm like, I can't believe that people do this. And I always, because when I was a kid, I always remember, there'd be other kids that would cheat, and I would always say to myself, I'm not gonna, if I ever actually called the ball out that I knew was in, I was like, I'm quitting tennis. Like the tennis is, it can't be that important that would do that. So to me, that's like one that means a lot to me. And the other kind of silly one is, we hold up the new balls, right? We should,
Yeah.
and I used to always get really irritated if my opponent didn't hold up the balls because I felt it was disrespectful. I
Yeah,
would, you would
totally.
never do that. Gigi Fernandez, would you hold up those new balls, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, I played fair. I mean, the thing is, like, there's a fine line between cheating and gamesmanship, right? I mean, you can press the envelope of playing mind games with your opponent, and there's certainly that. I mean, I think John obviously was good at the mind games. I was good at the
Definitely.
mind games.
Yep.
There's a magazine in the 19, I forget the year, but there's a tennis magazine and kind of year-end review, and the question was, who's the player most likely to intimidate? And John was the male and I was the female.
Right.
Because I always felt like there was two battles going on the tennis court, right? There was the physical battle and the mental battle. And you want to have the mental edge over your opponents because then the physical part becomes easier, right? So,
Right.
but yeah, the cheating is ridiculous. I mean, I've never, I mean, I got, I don't remember my junior days. That was 50 years ago,
Yeah, right.
but I'm
Let me
sure
I but and I appreciate you doing this, and I know we're running out of time here, but I want to
it's fine.
ask you
It's
this.
good.
Yeah, I want to ask you this because it came up again when I did an event before we did our event with Google for the Hall of Fame up at the Longwood Cricket Club a couple of nights ago. And it was a great turnout. And one of the questions I got, and I would often get this question from my daughter when she was playing junior tennis as a 10, 11-year-old. And she said to me, what someone said to me, Dad, how come the women play best of three and the men play best of five? I mean, I think we know the answer to that, but did that ever annoy you as a top female player?
No, I mean, it's obviously a physical component, right? That back in the day, people didn't think women could do it. But did it annoy me? No. I think it's kind of annoying that the men play five sets, I have to say.
Okay,
It's
yeah,
like, get it done
I've heard that
already.
before.
I
Yep.
mean, you don't need five sets. Just play three. It's,
Right.
I mean, for the fans and for the speed of the tournament and speed of the game, I think the grand slam should go to two out of three. I
Yeah,
really
that
do.
well, this is again, it brings us back to our topic, which is tradition. Some things are just
Right.
traditions, and one
Right.
of them being women play two out of three because they can't, play as long, which of course we now know is false. And the other
Right.
one, the men play best of five just because, well, they've always played best of five.
Right.
And so that, you wonder if that will ever change. A lot of things are changing in
I mean,
pro
that's one way
tennis.
to speed it
Yeah.
up, right? I
Yes.
mean,
Yep.
these matches that end at 2 a.m. won't finish at 2 a.m.
By the way, for the Google, for like it was a, I think I went to maybe the Wikipedia, as I do my research on all this stuff for, but as I researched like lawn tennis, one of the first things it says is, tennis began, it started in France and then it began as a more organized way it is today in England in the late 1800s. And they talk about, you know, how it started, and you know, it was originally played. You know, the setup was a little bit different. But and by the way, you know that when you first started playing, I'm going off on another tangent here. you could only serve right-handed.
What?
Did you know that? Yeah. So I did, because my brother did this show like 2 years ago. McEnroe's Places. It was part of Peyton Manning's thing, and he did one of the episodes. He came to Newport, and we took the original box that the tennis came from. It was like, I think it's called Svartnik. I'm trying to remember the name of what it was called, but Wingfield was a guy who put it in a box, and so you used to have a net, and the net was kind of almost more like a volleyball net. But anyway, when we started the match, John went ready to serve, and he's, you know, like he's obviously lefty, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "What do you mean? Because you can't serve lefty." That was when the original.
That's how you're going to beat your brother,
yeah,
finally.
That's what I said. I said, "Finally, I can beat you now if you have to serve right-handed." But my point is that some things are just traditions because they are. And what it said on the Wikipedia was the rules of tennis have changed very little over, you know, the course of its history, like the year. So that's kind of
that's
like,
true, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we should raise the nets.
Right.
Make it, you know, the serve less of a.
Well, I've seen some people say there should be one serve. You know, you should only have one serve.
Yeah. That would speed it up, too.
That would speed it up. Of course, Billie Jean King was, you know, play the lets, which we did playing in team tennis for many years.
And team tennis,
they,
yeah.
They do in big junior tournaments now on the ITF junior circuit. All right.
I think college tennis plays the nets, too, no?
Yeah, they do. The men have played lets for a while. In fact, even when I was in college, I don't think we played lets, but back when I was there. But it's gone back and forth. But do you know why the men, for a couple of years, the men played lets and the women didn't in college? That just recently changed. But for
why?
A number of,
because the women can't get to the lets.
No. Because men cheat. Men cheat more. So the guys. So you'd be serving at a huge point, right? And the guy would hit an ace, and you just call let.
Oh,
even like phantom lets, basically. Can you believe that? I know, how annoying is that? They would call
crazy.
Like, so they would just call a let, and because, you know, a lot of times there's no umpire or whatever, because in college, you know, there's six matches going on.
We're gonna have Hawkeye in college tennis pretty soon.
I would wholeheartedly agree.
So yeah,
all right. So there's some traditions that haven't died yet. The one and only Gigi Fernandez. Thank you so much, Hall of Famer and board member, for joining us, and thank you for all you do and continue to do for the Hall of Fame and for tennis.
Thank you.
I'm so happy,
thrilled to be here.
Happy to hear about your charity too. So that's tremendous.
Yeah, tennisforhope.org is if you want to become a member and help people in the tennis community that are being affected by natural disasters.
Sounds good. Tennisforhope.org. The great Gigi Fernandez here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast.